The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski, in Florence.
And me, Charles Arthur, in London.
And me, Jemima Kish, in London.
This week on the show,
there's huge numbers of creators and businesses basically whining that people won't pay for something which is expensive for them to make. And my argument is bad luck. If consumers don't see the value, you're never going to change that.
It's tough love from the author Nicholas Lovell, whose latest book, The Curve, sets out to give a cohesive strategy for turning online freeholders into hard cash-paying superfans. Also, I'll be joined by the tech team to reveal some of the big issues relating to privacy and the web as the EU attempts to regulate to protect privacy. And Phil Zimmerman tells people to wake up about consumer email services. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Data privacy, surveillance. Issues on the lips of the world in the wake of the revelations by Edward Snowden to The Guardian that the U.S. government was tapping into our online activities and our mobile phone calls. Inspired by these events, a Congress on Privacy and Surveillance was called in Lausanne, Switzerland this week. And Charles, you attended.
It was announced a month or so ago, following on from all the Snowden revelations. It's hard to say that it had a specific objective. It was really to bring a lot of people who are hard thinkers in the area together, to air a lot of the issues, to see if there was anything, especially in law, that could be done within Europe about the fact that the US has a big surveillance operation which is applied to some extent against its own citizens, but also very much against citizens of the world who are not people living in the US. And as was rather graphically shown with some video clips from a member of the Senate, basically, if you're not in the US, if you're not a US citizen, then they basically think that your rights are pretty much not of any interest to them.
Now, Charles, there were several really interesting people who were at this conference. For example, Casper Boden, who's an ex-Microsoft privacy advisor. What did he say?
He was interesting. He worked for Microsoft between 2002 and 2011. He was the privacy advisor for 40 countries, Microsoft activities, that is, in 40 countries, excepting the US, so not including the US. One of the interesting things that he said was that he said, "I don't trust Microsoft anymore," which I think is relating to the fact that he couldn't see the source code for Windows, for other software, so he couldn't be sure that he wasn't being surveilled in some way. He also said that he wasn't aware of the PRISM program, that is the program by which the NSA can access data which is held by companies including Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google, YouTube, and so on. He said he wasn't aware of that at all when he was inside Microsoft.
And Charles, how could he not know?
Because to talk about the existence of a NSA oversight system within Microsoft would in effect bring you inside the purview of that NSA order. So the NSA orders, the court orders that it gets from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, those orders are secret. You're not allowed to know who's named under them, whose data they refer to. And when a company which receives one of those FISC orders complies with it, it's not allowed to say who has complied with it, and you're in effect bound by the secrecy that goes around it. And there are very big penalties, including many years in prison for making those things public, which is something that Marissa Mayer pointed out recently. So he didn't know about it because if he had known about it, then he wouldn't have been allowed to talk about the fact that...
Yes, he would have had to kill us, basically.
Well, something like that, or himself, which and I don't think either would be particularly attractive.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned in the live blog was that he was using only open open platform. So he has completely rejected the Microsoft proprietary suite. What are his concerns?
His concerns are basically that you can't be sure if you're using non-open source software that the NSA and other organizations, you know, other intelligence agencies have not in some way interfered with it. So if you're not compiling the source, if you're not able to read through the source, then there exists the possibility that you might have been targeted, that someone might want, for example, to be listening to your conversations that you have online. So he said, for example, you know, he said, I haven't had a mobile phone for 2 years. That takes you back to when he left Microsoft. So, you know, you could, if you wanted, portray that as a paranoid point of view. But then again, we do know that there is a whole lot of surveillance that goes on.
One of the interesting things that you raised is that when he was talking about the roots of NSA spying, he mentioned Richard Nixon in 1978. What's the link there? Are we being, you know, too paranoid now? Should we have been paranoid since 1978? What's the story here?
Well, Richard Nixon was a president who was very concerned about knowing what people were saying about him, in trying to understand really who his enemies were.
See Frost versus Nixon.
Really, yeah, basically, or as
just,
well.
Actually, just see all the president's men, you know, with the whole war.
You do not need to know the truth. No, what's the line?
Oh my goodness, Robert Redford, are you in the podcast?
Well, you're thinking of A Few Good Men. That's all Guantanamo.
Okay, cut.
But yeah, so it goes back to, yeah, Nixon wanted to have a big surveillance operation, and the CIA, the FBI, and of course the NSA were all willing to help him get it, and so a lot of funding for the NSA came out of programs that Nixon helped to put in place, and as you know, tends to happen with surveillance. It always sees its own continuation as a great purpose. You know, its existence becomes the purpose of it existing.
Incidentally, Michael Hayden, who's a former NSA guy, spoke in London on Monday and pointed out that the framework for the National Security Agencies is based on something developed in 1947. So it goes back even further than Nixon.
One of the areas that Bowden mentioned or spoke about, and certainly something that seemed to be a theme throughout the day, was about cloud computing and how we are all moving data. I love this quote from a later speaker in the day, Bruce Schneier: you are leaving your data on someone else's drive if you're using cloud computing. So, you know, if Caspar Bowden is saying cloud computing is too useful to be disinvented, and, you know, we are basically putting our stuff somewhere that we don't have control over, what do we do, Charles? What can we do?
It's really hard to know. And possibly the sort of things that you need to think about are, if you value your privacy and if you don't want to be the subject of surveillance over that, well, actually, this solution goes in both directions. It goes off in opposite directions, in fact. If you want your privacy, then you would encrypt all the data that you upload. It would be stored in an encrypted form. You'd transmit it in an encrypted form. You would hold the private keys yourself. You would therefore, in effect, not have any data, even if it is stored on someone else's hard drive, you wouldn't have any data in a form which was plain text that could be read. However, if you were to do that, I suspect that you would pretty rapidly become the target of surveillance, because the intelligence agencies would start saying, why has this person got all this data encrypted? What are they trying to hide from us? So the twin sort of desires to have privacy and not to be surveilled actually pull in opposite directions there.
So how safe are our communications online? Guardian technology reporter Alex Hearn spoke with the godfather of email security, Phil Zimmerman, the inventor of PGP, who says that email can't be made safe and, concerningly, that it could potentially threaten journalists' anonymous sources. Welcome to the studio, Alex.
Thank you.
Alex, what does PGP do?
So PGP is still, as far as we know, an uncrackable way of securing the contents of an email or any electronic communications. It scrambles it using somebody's public key, and then that information is handed to the person whose key it is. They then use their private key to decrypt it. As far as we know, even after the NSA leaks, None of the world's intelligence services can actually break that scrambled data. It's done using extremely complex cryptography, which just the only way we know to break it is thousands of thousands of thousands of years of computing time.
What doesn't it do?
What it doesn't do is encrypt anything in the gubbins of email itself. When you send an email, that email has to tell all of the servers on its journey where it's going, who it's from, what time it was sent. If you encrypted that, your email wouldn't reach its recipient. Essentially, what PGP is a really, really strong lockbox that you then have to stick an address label on top of. The problem is that address label has to be readable by everyone, or that lockbox isn't going to reach its destination.
Now, you make the comment that this isn't just about consumer email. So I like your analogy here that it's like posting a letter in an indestructible envelope. No matter how well sealed it is, you still have to write the address on the outside or it won't get there. So actually, can you give me a little bit more information about what email standards are? What, you know, sort of what is it and how is this basically revealing things to those who are looking at those things?
Well, email is a very, very old standard. It's existed, I think, before even the web existed, although obviously it arose after the internet was born. But that standard requires the metadata of an email, the data around the contents of that email, to be publicly readable, not only by you and your recipient, but also by servers in the chain between. The message gets handed from server to server to server until it reaches its destination. And if you try and obfuscate that information, where it's coming from, who it's going to, your message might not be able to reach its destination. You know, it's the equivalent of writing the address on the front in an unbreakable cipher. It's all very good, and no one will be able to find out who you're posting it to, including the postman. There are possible solutions to it which would stop it being email. So there's ways of tweaking the email protocol to result in something that's a little bit more secure. But the problem is then it's not going to be backwards compatible and you can't send it using common email clients. And you end up with a proprietary replacement for email, which is the only way of communicating securely.
Why is what Verizon was doing, because this is ultimately what we were talking about when it comes to the when it comes to what the NSA was doing and why Verizon was holding on to certain content. Why is it problematic that Verizon was harvesting this metadata? Is it because you could see who was communicating with who else?
Well, quite. I mean, at the time that Verizon's big collections of metadata were made public, there was a lot of explanation as to how you can use data harvesting methods to find out quite a lot about a person from their metadata. So, for instance, you know, if you find that someone always sends emails from 5:30 in the morning, you know when they wake up. If you find that they send their last emails at 11:30 at night, you know when they go to sleep. If you know that there's a break in the periods between 8 and 9, you know when they commute. If you do this for long enough and, you know, start collecting the addresses they call, the phone numbers they call, all of this sort of thing, you can build up an uncanny picture of someone's life. But the point Zimmerman made to me last week is that actually you don't need to go that far for metadata to be dangerous. All you need to do, if you're the NSA and you're looking at communications coming out of Guardian Towers, is just find that one journalist has emailed one person in the MOD the day before a big story on a leak from the MOD has come. That's it. There's no massive aggregation that needs to be done. If an intelligence agency finds one email going from an inopportune source to a journalist, problems can happen.
There has been, of course, quite a lot of coverage on The Guardian of smaller email services going down because of these revelations about Verizon and, of course, the other revelations about how information is being tapped online. Is this the reason or is there another reason why these smaller email servers are going down?
As far as I know, and from what various secure email providers have told me, this is the reason. If you are running something which aims to be backwards compatible with email, you cannot make it fully secure. You can have informed users and you can tell them what the differences are. It's important to note that PGP is not a busted protocol. So long as you're aware that who you are and who you're emailing is public, it's still very, very useful. If you have contents of a message which you don't want to be read, PGP still works very well for that goal. But if you want to make something which is completely untraceable, completely unsecure, which cannot be logged, which cannot be tracked, email is not a good starting point for that. And that's what all of these providers are realizing.
But you also say that there is a silver lining, that there may be exposures if, for example, guardian.co.uk, or rather, if the guardian.com is sending an email address to mod.gov.uk, there may be alarm bells, mm-hmm. But it's okay. Like, there's still a way to, if not obfuscate, but there's a way to get around,
right.
Get around the eyeballs, as it were.
Well, obviously, the thing is, we can get too blinkered in the world of sort of cybersecurity by looking for entirely technological solutions to all of it. And actually, you know, if the NSA are looking for communications from the Guardian to the Ministry of Defence, that's one thing. If they're very unlikely to be looking at communications from the aunt of someone at the Guardian to the nephew of someone at the Ministry of Defence. You just have to start dropping back to older spycraft methods. It's not a foolproof
solution.
He says with glee, yes.
I know, I even heard the glee here. There was like a sparkle and everything.
But yeah, I mean, there may not be a technological solution to some of these problems, but there's still solutions. If you really need to communicate with someone and not let it be known who you are and who you're communicating with, you got to think outside the box.
I can see the dead letter dots coming back.
Yeah, exactly. Smoke signals. Jemima, isn't email going out of fashion anyway? I seem to recall that we reported on this extensively.
I'd absolutely love it if it went out of fashion. It is generally accepted that there are a number of sort of dynamic ways that email fails. Even leaving aside the security questions, it's effectively a to-do list of yours determined by other external people that can just email you and add to your to-do list, which doesn't make any sense.
I can hear the panic in your voice.
I know.
Actually,
various attempts
Hallelujah
to
that one.
Various attempts to organise it by using your social connections to determine what's at the top of the inbox have had sort of limited success.
Zero success. Like you mean?
Yeah, I'm thinking of priority inbox. It doesn't really work.
It doesn't work.
There are other people that I'm having interesting conversations with actually, who are developing alternative sort of email platforms that they don't want to call email. I think this sort of combination of information overload and the format essentially being broken, combined with the security concerns about it, will mean that in 5 years' time even, and hopefully much sooner than that, the email service that we use or rely on day to day will either have been replaced or completely transformed.
What are they calling them? Are they calling them like George, or are they calling them Bill, or are they calling them, I don't know, unicorns dancing through the sky?
That would be good.
Wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Unicorns. But look at the ways of communicating that we really enjoy. We like the brevity of Twitter, but we want something private and more secure. And there have been various sort of trends, like five sentences and things in email, to try and encourage us to just be a bit more productive and a bit more, I don't know, to give it some kind of new structure. But much more work to be done there.
Send us your thoughts on this to our email address. Haha, see what I did there? techweekly@theguardian.com or tweet us @GuardianTW. Of course, keep your eyes on theguardian.com/technology for more as it arises. And thank you to Alex for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Edward Snowden's whistleblown leaks have triggered a swathe of debates, discussion, and committees across Europe as legislators try to tackle the issue of electronic surveillance and whether European governments need to better balance the demands of openness with security. Charles, one of the issues that's under consideration at the moment is the safe harbor policy. What is it?
Safe harbor was established in about 2000, and it's basically an agreement that if you're an EU, European Economic Area company or person, and your data is transferred to a US company, then under safe harbor, if the US company is operating under safe harbor, then it treats your data in the same way as it would as if your data was staying in Europe. So it's essentially sort of for cloud computing and stuff like that. And the original, when I was first writing about this back then, I was trying to sort of explain it to my news editors and saying, well, if you think about Hotmail, which is Microsoft's webmail service, it's basically, you know, the stuff, the data that's in there, even though it's transferred to the US, you're meant to be able to treat it as though it's still staying over here. Of course, we now know that all the stuff around the NSA, it basically treats safe harbor as was, yeah, we didn't hear any of that, and is able to look at that data without any sort of regard to the whole issue of safe harbor, because it has a get out clause. Certainly you could call it a get out of jail clause, which is that, you know, if it needs it for its national purposes, for legal purposes, which, you know, what the NSA wants to do is essentially define as legal, then it doesn't have to worry about safe harbor.
It's an interesting question then that raises issues about privacy ultimately, and also the differences in attitudes towards privacy between, as is frequently been raised in these debates, between Europe, between the US, and sometimes the UK is separated out of that. But Jemima, there is a larger question in all of this. Because certainly people bring up the idea that in the past we had no privacy and, you know, remember when we lived in small villages, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, why is privacy important?
It's fascinating and quite hard to articulate. And in the very noisy NSA story, what we're trying to balance is a very powerful argument for being able to find out when terrorists are planning attacks, with a softer, more sort of nuanced issue of privacy, which is somehow sort of harder to articulate. Edward Snowden appeared yesterday, at least in the form of a speech that was read out by Jeslyn Raddick, who is the Human Rights Director of the Government Accountability Project. And this was at one of the committees that's been fired up by the NSA story, the European Parliament Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs. And what he said, I think, really beautifully illustrated the value of privacy, certainly in one sense, that the success of economies depends on creative output. Creativity is the product of curiosity, and that, in turn, is the product of privacy, which I think is incredibly compelling and very powerful. And to back that up, Stella Rimington, the former MI5 chief, has also said this week that the public won't trust security unless there's more transparency. We will see a lot more calls like that in the coming months.
We certainly will. And Jemima, thank you very much for that. Charles, thank you. And you can keep up with the latest on the NSA at theguardian.com/technology. Quite a lot of attention has been paid in recent months to government access to our digital shadows, those traces of our activities that we leave behind in our day-to-day online activities. But we seem to have forgotten that there are other parties interested in what we do online. Businesses who want to target advertising and products to us. Author Nicholas Lovell has just released his book, The Curve, an analysis of the ways companies, both big and small, can get us to buy their things. It's all about finding the superfans, he says. Well, how should they find them? Nicholas came into the studio earlier this week, and I found out. Nicholas Lovell, welcome to the podcast. You've been on the podcast before, but with another hat. You've been here specifically looking at the business of computer games. Now you've expanded your remit and you're looking a little bit more broadly. Tell us a little bit about your new book.
Okay, so the new book is called The Curve. It's out on October the 3rd. And really, it does absolutely build on my games background. The heart of the book is, as the web makes so many things go towards free, how will we still be able to pay for the creation of stuff? And that stuff includes art, whether or not that's books or music or visual art or games. And it also includes, over time, physical things, which with the advent of 3D printing and digital manufacturing are going to come subject to the same downwards pressures and threats of casual piracy that have bedeviled the other entertainment industries.
Certainly. And one of the ways that we have historically paid for the free stuff, because obviously there's nothing, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch, is by giving over our data. And today on the podcast, we've been speaking a lot about data privacy. And I was wondering if you could explore that topic with relation to how we will become post-physical consumers of the future.
Okay, so that's an interesting angle, because I've spent most time arguing with people about volume versus advertising and the challenges there. And I absolutely see that data becomes ever more of an issue. For me, the future of how we how we as consumers pay for stuff, how we as creators get paid for stuff, is around finding an audience, being able to talk to them again, and letting those people who love what you do spend lots of money on things they really value. That's a sort of mantra of mine. And the issue there is that requires an important element of trust. If you want people to become your super fans, you have to love them and they have to love you. So I actually think this will be there are challenges for data, but I think it's positive for data, because if you become that kind of person, that kind of organisation who treats your audience as data points to be mined and sold to the highest bidder, your ability to turn them into people who love what you do is deeply jeopardised. In some ways, I think that in the same way that to make a successful advertising business, you need volume because you treat all customers the same. If you're going to be a data business, even though it's personalised, you need a volume to make that work. I'm about personal relationships rather than data in its most general sense.
Moving slightly more, a slightly further look, a slightly more eagle-eyed view look at this issue, is when you're talking about personalization and you're talking about collecting the data from individuals who are seeking to buy or to pay for those things that mean a huge amount to them, you're also talking about the organizations themselves targeting those specific audience members. How will they do that? How will they find those communities? Or will they simply data mine or gather, utilizing the facilities that something like Google or Facebook, this sort of single identity facility, will they utilize that in targeting their advertising, in building their communities?
For me, I'm thinking about, as I say, the curve to me comes in three parts. You have to find an audience, which generally involves using free. You have to be able to talk to them again, and you have to have this high-end opportunity for the people who love you. You're focusing, quite rightly, on one mechanism of finding an audience. So I've tended to focus on create products that people love, whether or not that's content marketing in the sort of traditional business world, whether or not it's musicians who give their music away, whether they want to or not, through different sites. And you're adding an extra layer on top of that, which is that but actually these people exist in a whole bunch of different places. How can we find them? How can we use data mining? How can we use different techniques to find them? The thing is that having found them, you want to be able to talk to them again with their permission. And I believe you have to earn that permission. So I see the data mining as a fascinating starting point along the curve as you start going, these people have the potential to grow from being freeloaders to customers to superfans. But you can't do that just through data. Once you've got permission to talk to them, once they actually want you to communicate with them, you can then use another layer of data analysis to work out which ones are likely to not go very far along the curve and which ones might become your best customers. But just using data without permission, just using data without building relationships, I see that's going to struggle in a world where so much stuff is going to be available for free.
I think that's a really, really interesting element, what you said there, which is the building the relationship with the personal, but then you're also dealing with a mass market. I remember speaking with a group of used car salesmen who were trying to figure out what relevance the World Wide Web had to them. They knew, because everybody was talking about how they needed to go online, that they had to go online. But frankly, they deal with a very, very specific, very physical, very localized audience. So how should they adopt this notion of the curve? How should they identify their audience and use this model that you're proposing in order to gather people to their environment?
I think that's difficult and challenging, but I think you've got, there are many answers to this question. So in our world of games, we have free-to-play games, which put the game out for free and lots of people play it and some of them pay for it. And a game like Candy Crush Saga, top of the top grossing charts on Amazon. Everybody in my social circle has played it, particularly the mummies of my acquaintance, which is a surprising group to be gamers. And yet traditional core gamers would say, but you've changed the product. If you weren't trying to make money from this in this free curve way, the product wouldn't look like that. And there are some cases in which, as a creator, you build a product where the product is the curve, and games are a great example. But at the other end, well, a simple version of what I'm doing, audiences for books live on Amazon. They live in other places, but they live on Amazon. So we're giving away a free ebook to use the algorithms and recommendations engine. We're not data mining because Amazon and not, Apple or iBookstore don't let us. But we give the book away and we hope their algorithms recommend our book. So to an extent, that's putting it out there and hoping we find an audience. But we give away a separate product entirely for free and then connect into the existing network of recommendation engines, whether those are social, algorithmic or technical, and use that to drive our book. And then at the total different extreme, you imagine an artist who wants to create art, and that's incredibly important, but they build a website with samples of their art, perhaps with postcards, prints, perhaps with an ability to sign up for content. They showcase who's buying what they're doing. They showcase where they're displaying. They use that sort of social environment to say to people who might be interested in their work, look, I do really interesting stuff. Other people think it's interesting. Talk to me, build a relationship with me, and then eventually at some point maybe there'll be something you want to buy from me. It's very personal as well as being very global. What I think is really difficult to continue to do is to imagine that mass market. There is just a channel to market. I put my product in the channel and the channel delivers. I think those channels are getting harder and harder to manage.
Nicholas, what you're talking about basically is creating a relationship by giving people free things. And this is something that's happened throughout business history. How is this new? Or is it that nothing really is actually new, but over the last, say, decade and a half of doing e-commerce, we've tried to come up with lots of new ways that we're doing things, when in fact what you're saying is let's go back to basics. Let's actually think a little bit more about how we've been doing work, how we've been doing business in the past, and actually applying those basic principles to business again.
Okay. You've sort of added a third strand to my thinking. So I think that the web makes it possible for digital information to be shared incredibly cheaply, as used car salesmen are now using the web rather than classified advertisers in advertising in newspapers, for example. It also means that you don't have to be local anymore. You can sell globally. But as you rightly say, used car salesmen, people have a very local business. But there's a third thing they can do, which is to allow one-to-one relationships with your customers. Now, there is a problem with it's harder, with a business model where you buy one car every 5 years or so. Building that long-term relationship is challenging. Although, as anybody who's ever bought a car secondhand from a salesman will know, they make very little money on the car. They make the money on all of the ancillary services and actually have a reputation for not being trusted. My advice when buying a car recently, everybody said to me, is literally buy nothing, because they make all their margin on that, buy nothing. Now, that's a pretty poor relationship business where they're basically saying it's a single transaction. I'm probably a young person. I'm doing this sales for 5 years. I'm never going to see this person again. I'm just going to try and maximise my margin from them right now, today. I think that's going to get harder and harder. How does a used car sales business? It would be all about building the long-term relationships which say, having sold you that car, I can continue to sell you all of the ancillary things around that car, some of which you have to have, like MOTs and other servicing. Servicing is optional, but you are encouraged to do it. And some of which might be nothing more than personalised cleaning services coming down to your house, which can be very high margin for the super fan businesses. I don't have an exact answer, but the thing I would be focusing on is the web enables me to have a connection with you that is incredibly cheap. And it's that is the actual, I'm going to use a technical term here, disruptive force. And that's the thing I'll be trying to figure out how to take advantage
of. So how does the curve relate to other business proposals that we've heard about in the digital age, the long tail, crowdfunding, freemium? Where does the curve sit in this? It's not even a spectrum, it's more a kind of bag of tricks.
In my grandiose moments, I think of it as a unifying theory. That's my most grandiose phrase for it. So it builds on the long tail. The challenge of the long tail, as we all know now, and the long tail clearly exists, but what the long tail's done is enabled the big to get bigger. The niche hasn't entirely become more viable, and the big winners have been the aggregators, the Amazons and the Netflix and the Googles of the world, and consumers who get a lot more choice at a lot lower price. What the curve says is the long tail is simply it's taking the mass market and the web and putting them together and going, you can sell anything, but actually it turns out, but we can't sell enough because the constrained channels of the pre-internet age made it possible for the middle to survive. We're now seeing that the medium-sized businesses are really struggling. And so the curve sits on top of that and says you can be at the bottom of the long tail, but you have to have your own curve. It's not just the big and the small, it's the big mass market and it's the small niche who are connecting with fans and with audiences. That's how it ties into the freemium model. I tend to have a challenge with the freemium model that a lot of the time where freemium fails is that it moves from have it for free to somewhere between 2 and 10% of your audience paying a low fixed price. And that's hard to scale. And I'm saying absolutely, you've got to allow some people to spend a few dollars, some people spend tens of dollars, some to spend hundreds, and potentially some spend thousands or tens of thousands on your model. The important bit is that you have to find that audience and allow the people who love what you do to spend lots of money, which sort of fits in with all of those theories and kind of drives them all together.
Your primary focus in this is not just giving free stuff in order to build that relationship, but also find the correct balance of value for those individuals who are seeking the thing that you are providing them. Now, how is this new? I mean, surely this is simply an adaptation into the online world. Or rather, is what you're saying is none of this is new. It's just we seem to have gone off the track a little bit over the last 20 years of e-commerce when everybody's thought it's completely new. And let's go back to basics.
I definitely can't agree that none of this is new. I'd get in so much trouble for saying that. So for my publisher. But I think the angle that's come with this is I work a lot with people who make content for a living, and their default position of how much this is worth is, this is how much it cost me to make. I must add a margin. That's how much I'm going to charge. And anybody who comes from the sales world goes, that's not an easy sales process. I was once on a sales course a very long time ago when they said a good washing machine salesman doesn't tell you about the revolutions per minute and the temperature and the energy efficiency. It tells you that it gets your clothes cleaner, whiter, faster and cheaper. And I think that is the distinction that we have slightly lost. There are huge numbers of creators and businesses basically whining that people won't pay for something which is expensive for them to make. And my argument is bad luck. If consumers don't see the value, you're never going to change that. And what they value is other things. They value how anything they own makes them feel. They value how anything they own makes them look within a social context. And a large part of that has been internalized. We no longer just spend money to look bling, although some people do. But for other people, their knowledge of fine wine or their understanding of the expanded universe of Star Wars or something else is some form of self-expression. And so what I'm arguing is that you need to look for what it is that people value. The exclusive, the personal, the what it says about them, the everybody had to read 50 Shades last year, everybody had to play Candy Crush this year. That's the mass market end. How do you create that for smaller groups, for people to go, you know what, I am prepared to pay, and Kickstarter is a great example, or crowdfunding is a great example, I am prepared to pay $10,000 to support this art of a big hero of mine, and other people are happy to just pay $15 to see an album come to fruition, which they know they didn't have to pay for, and which they know they could have got for free once it had happened, provided it existed. It's part of that journey. It's value becoming very personal rather than very transactional.
But value shifts very quickly in the mass market, and it's difficult to be, you know, say a manufacturer of a mobile phone handset and say, well, we're just going to hold off actually building them. In fact, I'll use a very topical example. BlackBerry said we're going to build 10,000 or 10 million or however their run was of playbooks in the hopes that people will buy this thing that they didn't end up buying, which, you know, has led to their, or one of the factors that has led to their eventual demise. Are you suggesting that with the curve, you start with a small amount of product and then you are more flexible or more agile, as some successful high street fashion chains like Zara have been, creating a hyper data-oriented documenting system that gives the manufacturers exactly what it is that they need to know about how many things that they see flying off the shelves, and therefore their supply chain becomes that thing that is more agile, that has the curve. Apologies, the heavens have just opened at my suggestion. And the rain is coming down on Florence, so apologies if you can hear that.
We can hear it a tiny bit, but I think it's okay. I think there's so I'm a huge proponent of lean startup and agile methodologies, avoiding the HIPPO problem, the highest paid person's opinion, whereby you end up making something just because your boss thinks it's a good idea, is something which I've seen endlessly throughout my professional career. And yet there are some times when you have to take crazy big bets. There's no way around that. The iPhone would have been a hard thing to imagine launching on a purely iterative basis, as indeed is the next generation of video game consoles. So I'd like to there are other people cleverer than me working on this challenge. I absolutely think having very responsive supply chains, as you described, is an important part of it. I also completely believe that fashion and the value within fashion is extremely fickle, but I think there are some constants. I think there are some constants with being, I want to be the kind of person who's a trendsetter. And maybe the answer becomes at some point Zara has a subscription business like Amazon has a Prime business, which mainly only allows people to be the first to know. And that's what they're paying for. They're paying to be the first to know. These are, there's a phrase Ernest Hemingway uses to novelists. He has four words to successful novelists: write drunk, edit sober. And I'm a big believer that you should be allowed to throw ideas out, write drunk, and then after about 3 minutes stop and go, actually, you know, of all of those ideas, those two were really good and I'm not so pleased about the others. So there are moments when you're asking me questions I haven't prepared where some of that is happening. I'd be really interested in whether or not Zara could find a way to enable the superfans. I've certainly seen data that for a lot of fashion websites, 10% of their audience are between 80 and 90% of their revenue. Those people are already superfans, but they're buying stuff through the boutique that belongs a whole bunch of different designers. I think that the retailers have to get better at understanding those audiences and offering them things which they can buy which aren't necessarily just clothes. And similarly, and slightly in competition, the designers, the labels, the manufacturers need to get better at talking to those customers better in a bit of competition with the retailer. And how that plays out over time, retailers as channels and suppliers as channels, I think it's a fascinating challenge over the next
decade. Well, I must say, Nick, that either you were very drunk or you were very sober when you were writing and editing, because you do throw out some fantastically, you pull together a lot of really interesting stuff, a lot of really interesting case studies. And in fact, you talk about some of the big hitters. You talk about Trent Reznor, for example. You talk about Kickstarter. You talk about, you know, you bring things like 50 Shades of Grey even. You bring in some of the case studies that most people will have heard about because they have been phenomena. But I would posit that when it comes to, for example, things like Kickstarter or other crowdfunded sites, or even to a degree the self-publishing industry, that what happens is that you get one amazing case study, one amazing example of something that's surpassed everybody's expectations, and then that inspires people to gold rush, thus devaluing the free service that actually inspired the creative output in the first place. How do you find out first, as it were, what the best place is to reach your audience? And then how do you make sure that you can have, if not a monopoly or a controlling share of that, of the eyeballs and the ears? How can you make sure that other people jumping on board doesn't dilute your unique position in the market?
Okay. The curve isn't particularly an answer to how do I build a dominant global platform. You know, we definitely live in a winner-takes-all environment where Amazon is a global player, Kickstarter is the leading crowdfunder, eBay is leading auction house, and the big get bigger. And there are many different challenges to getting there. I focus much more on saying, how can you build a thing that will have an audience, which may not be huge, who love what you do, and let them spend lots of money on it? And if that thing, and that becomes a viable business, which you're quite happy with, if that thing then also breaks out into the mainstream, if that thing, through that combination of virality and luck and judgment and creativity and all those other things, hits the zeitgeist. If you ever saw Psy being interviewed about Gangnam Style, there was a humble viral sensation who basically said, I have no idea how this happened. I tried, I put my stuff out, I do this often, this one went global, I've no idea why. And good on him, because what he did was he put a huge amount of effort to put himself in the place where he could make a living from something without it going viral, and then when it goes viral, he makes an absolute killing. And I think that Candy Crush Saga is in that place. I think that the self-published sensation that is 50 Shades, not the subsequent published sensation, but the self-published sensation, which was 50 Shades, does exactly that. So I'm afraid to say, if you're hoping that The Curve says here's exactly how to build the next eBay, the next Kickstarter, even the next Candy Crush, I wouldn't say that it can do that. What it can say is here's to make a living making something which has the potential to become the next Candy Crush, and then you hope for that combination of luck, judgment, creativity and skill that brings it all together in a sort of magical process that nobody fully understands.
So don't sell the farm yet. Make sure that you become a Renaissance man or woman and do your passion on the side by putting it out there.
Yes-ish, make a living from your passion is definitely my objective. So I would happily help people head towards selling the farm, but not necessarily buying a New York penthouse.
Fair enough. Nicholas Lovell, thank you so much. And The Curve is coming out this week at the beginning of October. You should get it. Really interesting.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week. Thanks to the Tech Weekly team, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur, and to our special guest, Alex Hearn. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. We are back next week with even more from the tech world. I'm Alex Kratovsky. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
The Guardian.